Welcome to Texas Style Coworking. The Ranch Office is a neighborhood community office that delivers a warm atmosphere with a heavy dose of Southern hospitality. Located in Memorial, Katy, and Baytown, we offer private offices, conference rooms, event space, and much more. Come change things up and check us out. Remember, life is better at the ranch.
Humanity is growing and connecting. Tomorrow's world needs more energy from more places.
But to find our net zero future, we must overcome the natural constraints of many new energy sources.
This is the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, where we look at the energy challenges of modern life and the innovators finding solutions. Join us for a low-carbon, high-energy conversation with your host, Joe Battier.
This views of the host are his own and should not be viewed as those of any business, corporation, or government entity.
All right, we are recording. Hello, and welcome to the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Battier. This is the show where we bring you low-carbon, high-energy stories from the people solving the energy challenges of modern life. I am here today with Jigar Shah, Director at the U.S. Department of Energy Loan Programs Office. We are at CERAWeek by S&P Global. This week, we just had the LPO release, or the DOE release, the newest liftoff report, specifically focused on next generation geothermal. Really excited to talk about this. So instead of me rambling, I am going to let Jigar get on the mic and start talking. Jigar, thank you for joining me on the show today. If you would please share with me and the audience your background and a quick introduction to the LPO.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I have been in the energy industry a long time, originally in the worked at BP and then, you know, started my own solar company, Sun Edison, and then, you know, was in the investing space with Generate Capital and joined the Department of Energy with this administration in 2021. And, you know, as the director of the Loan Programs Office, it's exciting time to be here. The Loan Programs Office, when we first came into office, had about $40 billion of loan authority. We were famous for doing the first five, you know, 100 megawatt solar farms back in, you know, 2010, you know, the Tesla loan out of the Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Program, the loan to Ford and Nissan. And we did the first geothermal projects during that boom in 2009, right? So so we have been doing geothermal for a long time, some good, some bad. And so today, we've really revitalized the office and gotten a lot of private sector interest. So we're up to about 203 active loan applications, seeking about $261 billion from our office. And we were given a lot more loan resources during the Inflation Reduction Act. So so we're here to help folks really get across that bridge to bankability and really get to full commercialization of these really important technologies.
Yeah, I think that it's one thing that many people don't think about, that valley of death for startups and understanding what opportunities there are out there for these startups to get across that valley of death. I love that phrase, bridge to bankability, that I haven't heard until you said it earlier this morning. So I really like that. And so today we're going to focus in on the next generation geothermal liftoff report.
Yeah.
But before we jump into that specifically, for anybody who doesn't know, what are these liftoff reports? What is the purpose? And just like a quick snippet of what they are and why they exist.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I find that there are policymakers who are deep into the weeds of all this stuff to pass bold laws like the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act. And then there's technologists who are deep into this because they're 10 years into their technology and bringing it to market. But when you talk to the institutional capital providers, right, who are really our partners at the Loan Programs Office, right, because we really provide the essential debt for first of a kind, second of a kind commercial deployments. But someone's got to raise the equity and bring that money in too. And so what you find is those folks have never heard of this stuff. And so figuring out how to put together that fact base and figuring out like, well, what's real, what's not real, what could people expect out of the cost reduction curve for, you know, next generation geothermal? What are the basics around the technology? Why are we so confident that it's going to work, right? And there's no technology risk here per se. There's certainly execution risk, you know, but there's not an underlying technology risk because we're really leveraging the breakthroughs from the oil and gas industry here, et cetera. That entire fact base is laid out by the Department of Energy. And so what you find is that it really crowds in a lot of private sector capital. And so we're trying to be helpful to the industry broadly, whether it's geothermal or the previous ones in nuclear or long duration energy storage or hydrogen or virtual power plants. There's just this education that's required. And we are in a great place to do that because of our 10,000 engineers, scientists, and experts that live on the DOE and the National Lab platform.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the greatest R&D groups in the world. And another aspect that I really like about the DOE and all the different funding is that aspect of being, I think the SBIR calls themselves America's seed funding. So it makes sense having these liftoff reports and the way you laid it out there. So let's talk about the next gen geothermal, kind of walking through the report high level, starting with the understanding of kind of what it is. So starting in chapter one, it's kind of a consensus or conclusion to the report. So what would be considered a liftoff target, or where would we be if we were to be lifting off geothermal?
Yeah, these reports are designed to be pretty short and sweet, and the executive summary is even shorter and sweeter. But, you know, the top line is that to get across that bridge to bankability, we think we need to deploy between 2 and 5 gigawatts of geothermal, roughly $25 billion of capital required to really get to, you know, the Secretary's Earthshot goals, right? So she's already put out an Earthshot goal of $45 a megawatt hour by 2035. To get there, we probably need to be at like $70 a megawatt hour by 2030. And our sense is that we're actually on track. When you look at the fact that drilling costs for enhanced geothermal have come down by 50% just in the last 2 years, we think that we're on track just by establishing and implementing best practices from the oil and gas industry, if you fully get that completed by 2030. And that, we think, will take 2 to 5 gigawatts worth of deployment to get there.
Now, is that 2 to 5 new gigawatts? And specifically in that EGS, AGS space?
Yeah, I think it is new gigawatts. I mean, certainly, you know, the Fervo folks did an extraordinary test here at Blue Mountain, which, you know, we funded in LPO 1.0 there, and we're super excited about that. But, like, I think that it's not accurate to say that we will have all the lessons learned if all we're doing is fixing old hydrothermal projects. Our sense is that you're going to have to do brand new projects too and really get that confidence level built in to investors, right? Because it's one thing to do existing sites where the subsurface is fully mapped out, everybody knows exactly what's going on. It's another thing to go to brand new sites where you have existing oil and gas leases, right? I mean, one of the things that we outline here is that all oil and gas leases actually can be converted to geothermal leases, right? And so you can, like, really speed up the permitting process and speed up the acquisition process if you're able to use these existing oil and gas leases in these states. But, like, getting that confidence level within the capital markets to do a brand new site is part of what we're trying to accomplish within the first 2 to 5 gigawatts of deployment.
Yeah. And so I think that there's an interesting point right now. And depending on who you talk to, where they're from, whether it's the size of company or private equity or venture capital, there seems to be mixed reviews on where geothermal is. Some of these people think that the boat's already sailed, they've missed the opportunity. Others think that it's still not quite there. So I think just from a large scale investment perspective, what would you say as far as opportunity? Is there Is there opportunity? What kind of level of opportunity exists?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that by definition, if everyone recognizes that something is an opportunity, then you can't make money. Right? So the reason why this is such a wealth-creating opportunity is because there's so much difference in points of view. And the and fortune, favors the bold. And so I think there are some people who see the potential in this, right? You saw Devon Energy lead the round in Fervo, but you also saw three or four large venture capital firms put in their first seed round and A round investments into new geothermal companies, right? And so I don't need everyone to buy into this thesis. I need a few people to buy into this thesis. And I think we've achieved that. So I think that part is fantastic. And now those companies have the resources they need to build their first of a kind project, which is great. And they're going to build them, and we're going to support them with debt from the loan programs office. And if they succeed at getting that first project done, I'm sure they'll crowd in more money, right? And that's how this works. And so the one thing, I think is really important for everyone to recognize is that this is how it always works, right? When the loan programs office funded Tesla, there were very few people who thought electric vehicles were going to be a thing. Right. And even in 2013, people were like, they're never going to make it. Right. They're losing way too much money for a car. Right. So I find that we are always funding into an area where the conventional wisdom is, I don't know if this is going to work. Right. Yeah. But there's a few folks who do think it's going to work, and they put in the equity and then we're off to the races.
Yeah, that's, I like that viewpoint. It's really, it is simple, it is intuitive, but most people don't think that way. If it's not going to work, or if everybody thinks it's going to work, well, then there's no money to be made.
Yeah.
So you have to be looking for those opportunities. So as we talk about geothermal and next generation geothermal, let's focus in kind of in chapter two, what are those key technology breakthroughs? So for those who are still on the fence, getting a few more to jump over, what are those key technologies that have occurred in the past few years that are really making this opportunity ready for liftoff today?
Well, look, I think that when you think about just how groundbreaking it is for the United States to be at the level of oil and gas production that it's at today, right? That is really a function of getting better at horizontal drilling, getting better at, fracking rock and really releasing molecules to get, to get up to the surface. And so when you think about where we started in 2008, 2009, we were probably at $60, $70 lifting costs, right? Today, you can make money, at much lower costs of oil. And that's because of this extraordinary amount of technology breakthroughs, not just in drilling, which of course is, quite well documented, but also in AI and data analysis and putting fiber optic cable down the hole so that you can actually figure out exactly where the heat pockets are and get continuous monitoring of how the well's doing. All of those technologies together really, are what allows you to create your own heat pockets, right? Fundamentally, the traditional hydrothermal business was really around finding these very specific places where you had permeability and, you had places where, water could come together and steam could be created and then, a loop could be installed. Today, you can actually manufacture that process by yourself anywhere where heat exists, right? And that's all technology that really comes out of the oil and gas industry that, frankly, is being repurposed to the geothermal industry. And that's why the $25 billion number is so low. The most of the bridge to bankability reports really assume $100 billion or $200 billion in some cases, right? And so the reason why it's only $25 billion here is just because so much work has been done in the oil and gas industry.
That's a really important point that most of these industries, if you think of something like solar, it is a truly new technology, or fusion is a new technology. Whereas here, a lot of the technology and what is unlocking geothermal is a transfer of technology, which that it does seem like a great opportunity. What was the most surprising technology point or new thing as you were doing the research and as the liftoff report was getting finalized? What was the most surprising thing to you in that report?
Well, honestly, I think what was so surprising is when you look at the work at Forge, right? You know, the test facility that we have for the Geothermal Technologies Office. You know, it was just, I think the first well took something like 21 days or something. And, you know, by the time we got to the eighth one, I think it was like 7 days. I mean, it was just the improvement is just so fast. And, you know, it's not because, we really came up with a breakthrough as much as the people who do this work are just so talented. And, you know, the first time they were being careful and really trying to figure out how they did it right. And then, you know, they were innovating on the fly on the execution side. They were saying, oh, if I do it this way, I can, like, skip this step. If I do it this way, I can actually move slightly faster. If I do it this way, I can do that. And so this is really about tradespeople, like, learning how to move faster because they've figured out the secret sauce on how to do this, right? And so the most exciting thing is this is actually know-how, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not a technology story as much as it's a learning by doing story. And we have so many extraordinary people in the oil and gas industry who, frankly, want to try new things, want to try different things, who want to come over to the geothermal side. And so giving them an opportunity to show their expertise, that's kind of exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So in chapter three, you kind of lay out what it's going to take to be considered commercial. One of those key components or those key metrics to hit is that 3 to 5 gigawatts by 2030
yeah.
that you've mentioned, 20 to 25 billion in investment.
Yeah.
What are some of the key points on how or what needs to get done to actually get there?
Well, I think when you think about what it looks like to do confidence building, right, which is what we're talking about here, it's generally not a technical thing, right? As we suggested, we can't just rely on fixing hydrothermal facilities. Yeah. Like, we got to do a brand new facility. So that's, I guess, technical. But when you think about what happened in the hydraulic fracturing industry, you know, like, we were basically drinking our own Kool-Aid sort of 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. And then when the global, you know, oil industry started coming after us, and, you know, and spiked oil prices to try to put, you know, hydraulic fracturing folks out of business, there was just this, rising up of folks saying, we can actually innovate, we can get our costs down, we can make it through this, we can make it happen. The level of confidence building that occurred in that 2013, 2014, 2015 timeframe is what was able to propel people into a more confident posture, which is what got us here today, right? On the geothermal side, it's sort of the same, right? Is that, like, you have to do this hard work, right? You've got folks like Google and others who've said that they want to buy the power,
yeah.
right? So that's not the issue. But you got to get folks to do the hard work, and then they're going to have to fail just a little bit. Right. And then they're going to be like, you know what went wrong? Oh, this is what went wrong. Let me fix that. Right. And then when they show that they have the confidence to do that next deal and then the next deal and the next deal, then, you know, that confidence is infectious. Mm. Right. And then investors start to see that confidence and go, wow, they're not uneasy anymore. These guys actually know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Right. They actually feel like they're going to nail this. Right. And state regulators start to see the same thing. And now suddenly the state of California, the state of Nevada, the state of Utah start to say, you know what, we want 20% of all of our electricity to come from this resource. Right. We want to, like, really lean into this stuff. Right. With, like, in the same way they did for solar or wind or, you know, other technologies. That's what it feels like to really achieve that commercial success. Right. When all of the parties around the table, from the state to the utilities, to the investors, to the, you know, drillers and the developers, all go, this is going to work. You know, like we're not just trying to roll this boulder uphill, but now we got to the top and it's starting to go downhill a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. So kind of on that idea, one of the things that, and I've been doing geothermal for approximately 15 years, started in grad school and have turned that into a career and hopefully a long career. But one of the things that the rhetoric is right now is that we're in this cautious optimism of lots of interest, lots of funding coming in, relatively lots compared to the past 10 years. And there's this concern of one major failure or one big failure, and we're going to sour everybody's taste buds and nobody's going to want to keep going. And that's kind of what Chapter 4 is about, is talking about risks to development.
Yeah, it's real. I mean, I was there, right? 2008, we were like, Iceland's the best, and we need to do geothermal just like Iceland does in the United States. And like, you know, put to the side that we're the largest geothermal industry in the world, but, you know, in any case, we should be like Iceland. And so then, you know, U.S. Geothermal raised all that money. We got all those projects built during LPO 1.0, and a lot of those projects didn't quite live up to its full form, right? And we learned some things, and, you know, so I get it. You know, people are gun shy and they're like, well, is this really different, right?
Yeah.
It is really different, right? What makes this different is that if you somehow do something wrong here, right, and one of the 13 heat pockets that you basically establish and connect gets done incorrectly, it's a $5 million hit.
Yeah.
And then you just drill another heat pocket, right? And so, like, I think that, you know, whereas geothermal 1.0 is really like all or nothing. It's like you got to drill right to the, you know, the right spot, and if you missed it, well, you lost $30 million and you got to start over, right?
Yep.
This one is more forgiving, right? I mean, and so as a result, I do think that you're going to see a lot more success this time around. And I just think when you think about how many tens of thousands of people are trained on how to do this in the oil and gas sector, I think it's something like 400,000 or 500,000 people, right? That, and a lot of those folks want to try something new. They want to try something different. And frankly, the oil and gas industry has been so efficient over the last 5 or 6 years. We got probably 20% of that supply chain that's sort of left over excess, right? And so a lot of those drilling rigs are sitting around looking for something to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think that you've got willing partners, a really excited supply chain that wants to get to work. And so we'll see. Obviously, you know, like, things happen, right? And not everything goes right the first time. But I do think that this time around, there's a level of momentum and a level of expertise, I feel like, that people are bringing to the table that I'm pretty bullish.
Yeah, I like that. So with the idea of risk, are there any other specifics or thoughts that you've got on how to mitigate risk, really from that investment standpoint and from that scaring people off standpoint?
Well, to be clear, like, when you think about all the tests we've done at Forge since 2018, I mean, that is what that is, right? And all that data has been published and folks have pored over it and looked for, you know, mistakes and other things that we could be testing. And DOE is going to continue to do that. We just awarded additional grants to people for additional tests. And so we're going to continue to keep making sure that we're, you know, measuring 12 times and cutting once. But at some point, you can't just stay in the lab. At some point, you got to do stuff big, right? And that's where we are. That is the point that we're at, right? And so I'm excited, right? And like I said, like, you know, the beauty of where we sit is that we do all the work. We do all the homework. We do all the due diligence. We work our butt off. But we're not guaranteeing success, right? What we're guaranteeing is that we know that the technology will work, that the underlying science is solid, right? But now we got to go execute. And sometimes that execution is perfect, and sometimes it's a little wobbly, but I believe in, you know, the American workforce, the American supply chain. I think we're going to get it right.
Yeah. Yeah. And at some point there's always that level of risk, and the best that we can do is emphasizing or clearly articulating that risk and then letting the investors decide if they will accept the amount of risk there is. and continue to drive down and reduce the risk as much as possible.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it also depends on which investors, right? I mean, yeah. Some investors obviously have much higher rates of return expectations and they're willing to take more risk.
Yeah.
And others, you know, have very low risk tolerance, but then they have very cheap capital, right? And so you have to balance between those two.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the last chapter in the liftoff report is, the way that I saw it, is basically a list of indicators for progress on the geothermal development goals. I don't really have a clear question here because it's a list of indicators. So for those reading the report, what should they really focus on, or what's that takeaway from Chapter 5?
Look, I think that when you think about who the liftoff report was written for, it's for institutional investors who, frankly, probably lost some money 20 years ago in the geothermal industry and haven't looked at it since, right? And so the goal for us is to go to them and say, this is not your grandfather's geothermal industry, right? This is leveraging all the extraordinary accomplishments and technology breakthroughs that America has come up with over the last 15 years. And watch carefully. And those indicators are there for you to watch carefully. If you're ready to be first, we'd love for you to come in first. Most of you are going to come in third. And so sit around, look at those indicators. We're going to start, you know, publishing those through the Geothermal Technologies Office, through the Department of Energy, through the industry. And when you feel comfortable that we actually predicted the success accurately and properly, right, then come in third, right, or come in fourth, right? $25 billion doesn't raise itself. It raises, you know, itself $250, $300 million at a time, right? So you don't have to be part of the first cohort. You don't have to be part of the second cohort. But there's going to be a 10th cohort, and we want you in then, right? But, like, but ultimately, the goal here is to make this less scary.
Yeah.
Right. For a lot of people, they just don't understand what are the common practices between the developers and, you know, the permit agencies. What are the best practices between the folks who are building the projects and, you know, the drillers? Right. What risks do these guys take? What risks do those guys take? Right. What is the role of an inspector? Right. Who comes in after the drilling is completed and verifies that it was done correctly? Right? How much can you take that inspection report to the bank, right?
Yeah.
All of these concepts are brand new to wind and solar investors. They're commonplace to hydraulic fracturing investors, right? So you can imagine that hydraulic fracturing investors are probably the first ones in because they feel very comfortable by all these risks, but then they probably have more expensive money too, right? And then the wind and solar investors are probably like, this is all foreign to us. We don't even know what the hell we're looking at, right?
Yeah.
But their money is a lot cheaper, right? And so there's going to be a blend between those two investment asset managers. My sense is it's going to be probably 100% hydraulic fracturing investors and 0% wind and solar in the first go. But over time, there's going to be a blending that comes in. And then as that occurs, the cost of capital comes down, which is another way you get geothermal power to be cheaper, right? And we're excited for it. We're excited to see this American technology repurposed to geothermal and, you know, for geothermal to take its place as a mainstay tool for decarbonizing our grid.
Yeah. So one thing, thinking broader picture here now, one of the first points made was the need for firm baseload power at the beginning of the report. And I think the estimates came to an average of around 900 gigawatts by 2050, clean, firm power.
Yeah.
And in the report where you state anywhere from 120 up to maybe 160 gigawatts of next generation geothermal. Similar to the blending of finance opportunities, how do we blend in, or where do you expect and where do you see the rest of that almost 700 gigawatts of power coming from?
Well, we have a lot of tools. And so, you know, I mean, the Department of Energy's job is to make sure all those tools cross the bridge to bankability and are available for the private sector to scale up, right? So the president announced tripling of nuclear capacity at COP28. So certainly that's, you know, where some of it might come from. We've got over 37 gigawatts of hydro that needs to be relicensed over the next 15 years, and we have next generation technology there, so we're excited there. You've got geothermal, which I think we're predicting roughly 90 gigawatts to be constructed by 2050, which is wonderful. But then you also have other sources of clean firm, right? I mean, solar and wind can be clean firm too if you pair it with long duration energy storage, right? Yeah. Natural gas can be clean firm if you pair it with carbon sequestration and storage, right? And so we're excited about all of the different technologies, all the different breakthroughs, all the different programs we have in the Department of Energy to help those technologies cross that bridge to bankability. And the goal is to have a diverse set of tools so that not only are we protected from, you know, being reliant on any one tool, but also we have 50 states and territories, right, as well, and all of them need different tools, right? Because, like, right now, geothermal, the first wave of states is really going to be in the West before, you know, the next wave and the next wave, you know, become cost effective. And so some states aren't going to be able to take advantage of geothermal, and so they might want to use nuclear, or they might want to use long duration energy storage, and we want to make sure that all those tools are available for them as well.
Yep. And so we didn't really talk too much about LPO more broadly, touching on it, but
we're a bank.
What do you want the LPO's role to be in the energy transition and liftoff for geothermal, really in getting all of these new technologies deployed?
Well, let me answer that question from a couple of different directions, right? For commercial scale projects, we want to be a reliable source of debt, right? We want people to be able to count on us being there when they're ready for us, right? And what that means is that there might be a seed stage investor or an A series investor who decides to not invest in something because they say, well, what if I am successful? Well, then that commercial project is going to be $1 billion, and where the hell am I going to get $1 billion from? Huh. Right? And so we don't want that A investor to flake out because we're not dependable.
Yeah.
Right? So we want to be there so that people know that when these technologies get to a certain level of maturity and they're ready for us, that we're ready for them. Hmm. Right? And so I think that's one role that we play. I think the other role that we play is that we leverage the 10,000 engineers, scientists, and experts on the DOE platform in the labs, right? And so when we provide a conditional commitment to something, it sends a huge bat signal out saying, we have reviewed this project, and we are not taking technology risk.
Yeah.
Now, we might be taking operations risk, we might be taking execution risk, but we're not taking technology risk. And people desperately want that bad signal because they don't have 10,000 engineers, scientists, experts on their platform. And so those equity investors actually rely on us to do that work, right? And they want us to go first. And that is an exciting role for us to play, right? And a lot of our companies raise equity after we provide a conditional commitment, and every one of them so far has succeeded in being able to raise that equity, right? Which is great, right? In terms of liftoff, we are given extraordinary amounts of confidential information, right? And while we would never reveal that confidential information because it's covered under the Trade Secrets Act, we can put a lot of that information together in an aggregate source of data to help reveal to equity investors and others where the industry is trending and where it's going. And so when you look at all the data that we collect, but also our friends at the Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations and the Manufacturing Supply Chain Office, getting that data, elevating it so that we're not just all taking some of the hype claims and press releases, and I understand why people do that, right? But being able to actually validate that data and publish it in a liftoff format is something we're uniquely capable of doing because people are not going to lie to us in these applications. And even if they did, we have external advisors that we're hiring to evaluate their loan applications, so we'll figure it out, right?
Yep.
And so I think having the DOE logo on these data sets is hugely important to really building trust within the, you know, institutional investor space.
Yeah.
Right? And we want to be able to get this bridge to bankability to be shorter, right? Yeah. I mean, for solar and wind, it was probably like 15 years, you know? It'd be nice to get some of these down to 7 years. And so for the geothermal liftoff report, we're hoping it happens by 2030, right? So that'll be like 6 years.
Yeah, I like it. I think that's a good spot to wrap up this conversation. Now, I do have some final questions I always ask my guests.
Sure.
So the first one being, what's a favorite book of yours that you would recommend?
Well, my favorite book is Fooled by Randomness by Nassim Taleb. And like, you know, it's just one of those things where I feel like false precision and bravado like sort of gets in the way. You sort of have to recognize where you actually like play a useful role and where like, you know, you got lucky. I think a lot of folks forget about that.
All right. I like that. I will add that one to the list. The next question, how do we get to net zero and beyond?
Well, there's no right answer to that question, right? You know, the way that DOE helps us get to net zero is by making sure that all these tools are available to the private sector to scale up. But the private sector and state, you know, governments and others are going to decide exactly which mix of tools they decide to use to hit net zero. And sometimes it'll be exactly what the modeling results show is the cheapest pathway. And sometimes it'll be not the cheapest pathway, right? It's going to be the pathway that employs the most people or, you know, uses their current assets in the agricultural space or whatever it is, right? But, you know, we want to make sure that we're providing people all the tools so that they've got them all ready in a commercialized fashion so they can deploy them at scale.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good answer. Now, you get to ask me a question.
So are you confident yet that this time's going to be different, that we're actually going to make this work?
Yeah, I am. And I think I've always been confident in geothermal, whether right or wrong. And I will always continue to be confident in geothermal.
Well, look, I think that is what it takes, right? Got to have this stalwart of people who believe in this and actually are willing to push it, right? And willing to, you know, really get that enthusiasm level up, right? I mean, I think the technology and the facts really matter, which is what we're talking about in the liftoff report. But the enthusiasm level matters even more sometimes.
Yeah. And to give a shout out to our colleagues at the Geothermal Technology Office, they're all amazing and always probably more on the enthusiasm and excitement trying to push forward with geothermal in all the different aspects, which is something that if you haven't read the report yet,
then shame on you.
Shame on you. But this one focuses on electricity generation, and I think at the end it said there will be another one focused on direct use and subsidiary technologies.
That's
correct?
Stay tuned.
Yes.
Stay tuned. It's coming. But no, we're excited. And honestly, walking around CERAWeek this year, the amount of excitement around geothermal is way higher this year than it was last year. I think people really see it being real right now, and that's exciting to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jigar, thank you for joining me on the show today. Before we sign off, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Go Illini. March Madness.
All right. Go Illini. You heard it here. Well, thank you again, Jigar. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on this episode of the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, share with a friend, leave a review telling me what you're enjoying most or what you'd like to hear more of. If you want to hear more news and energy-related stories, we have all sorts of energy-related podcasts on OGGN. You can find them by connecting with us on LinkedIn or visiting us on the website. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, corrections, or have a story that you would like to share, send me an email. That email address is joe.battier@oggn.com. And if you don't use email, find me on LinkedIn. And until next time, remember to keep it low carbon and high energy.
Join us again next week for another low carbon, high energy story on the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at oggn.com.